Tonight, our special guest on Coast to Coast, Greg Braden. His work, The Divine Matrix, Bridging Time, Space, Miracles, and Belief, is going to be another one of those classics. We'll be back with Greg in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. A former senior computer systems designer for Marietta Aerospace, computer geologist, Phillips Petroleum, and the technical operations for Cisco Systems, Greg Braden, is considered a pioneer in bridging the wisdom of our past with the science, healing, and peace of our future. For more than 20 years, Greg has searched high mountain villages, remote monasteries, forgotten texts to uncover their timeless secrets. Now, to date, his work has led to such paradigm-shattering books as The Isaiah Effect, The God Code, and his newest, The Divine Matrix, Bridging Time, Space, Miracles, and Belief. Greg's work will show us beyond any reasonable doubt that we've got the power to reverse disease, redefine aging, and even change reality itself by embracing the focused power of human emotion as the quantum language of change. We'll explain all that in a moment. Greg Braden. Hey, Greg, welcome back. How are you?
George, it's a pleasure to hear your voice, and I'm absolutely thrilled to be speaking with you from the snow-packed high deserts of northern New Mexico tonight.
Kind of an unusual snowfall out that way.
It has been, if you want to go skiing anywhere in the world, it's not in the Alps and it's not on the East Coast, it's not in the West Coast, it's right here in the Rockies this year.
This weather is just upside down, Greg. I don't know what's going on. Maybe that's part of this divine matrix.
We can talk. You know, George, what we're going to talk about tonight, this topic is so fundamental to everything that's happening in our world and in our lives that there is no topic that would not be relevant to what we're going to do tonight. So we can go anywhere with any of this tonight.
What do you mean by the divine matrix?
Divine matrix, it's a field of energy. George, Western science has just arrived within the last years of the 20th and now the early 21st century at an understanding that we have proven under laboratory conditions in the language of science that has been the place where ancient and indigenous traditions have always begun. So Western science is only now comfortable embracing the fact, and it is a fact now, that there is an intelligent field of energy that bathes all of creation, permeates everything in our world and beyond as far as we know, and with implications we're only beginning to understand. So scientists, they're publishing this in the journals, some great texts. Many of your guests have talked about this field. Scientists are looking at this and they're saying, okay, well, you know, this field is out there. What do we do with it? And this is the place where I believe it serves us to go into some of the most ancient traditions, some of them 5,000-7,000 years old in the case of the Vedas, because they began with this understanding. They said, sure, you know, everything's connected. And they spent their time, 1,500, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years, devising the understandings and helping to pass to future generations how this field applies in our lives. They didn't need to spend so much of their time proving that it's there for them. They used it in their lives.
Lynn McTaggart calls this the field. I have always called it a wireless internet. Are we all on that same page, Greg?
We are, George. This field is so new that scientists have yet to agree upon a single name. I've had the honor of sharing a stage a number of times with Dr. Edgar Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
He calls this nature's mind. Stephen Hawking calls it the mind of God. Lynn McTaggart, the folks at Noetic Science, simply call it the field.
Right.
Max Planck, in 1944, in just a stroke of brilliance, identified this field as the matrix. And what he said, in 1944, he said that all matter, the stuff our world is made of, he said it originates and exists only by virtue of a force. And he said, we must assume behind this force the existence of what he called at that time a conscious and intelligent mind. And then he said, this mind is the matrix of all matter. And it was based on those studies that the movie series was actually based on the work from Max Planck back in the 40s.
Well, you know, if you look at some of these pictures, Greg, from the Hubble, and you look at this vastness of the universe, at least this universe, and we'll talk about the possibilities of more than just this one, but everything to me has purpose now. It has order. I don't know what it all means. I don't know why all these nebulas and constellations and various galaxies that we're stumbling across now, I don't know what their purpose is, but they all seem to fit some kind of larger puzzle, don't they?
Well, they do, George, and I think with the beautiful symmetry of everything we're speaking about, that there have been some very far-seeing scientists in our past. The Max Planck was one of them. Dr. John Wheeler, a colleague of Einstein's, who is still with us today, and I believe he's still active at Princeton University, he began talking about the implications of what this field means in our lives in a way that was very, very different from what other scientists were saying during his time. And even now, he's caught a lot of flack for some of the comments that he's made, because what this book, The Divine Matrix, is all about, what scientists are understanding under laboratory conditions, and what 5,000-year-old texts are saying to us, is not only does this field exist, and not only are we part of this field, but we have the ability, George, within each of us to communicate in a meaningful way with this field in ways that seem, in the Western world, miraculous on the one hand, and on the other hand, this is why we've spent time in the monasteries of the high plains of central China, mm-hmm. and Tibet and in Egypt and Bolivia and Peru, because it's in these places where people have retained the understanding of what this field means and how to use it in their lives, healing their bodies and doing things to us that look like miracles. But to them, it's not a miracle. It's a technology, because they have remembered something that actually was part of our culture. When I say us, I mean us in the Judeo-Christian West, until the instructions that tell us how we use this field were actually edited among the 45 books that were edited out of our biblical text in the 4th century. So when we began rediscovering the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi Library, what we found was, as good as our Western biblical text is, and it's a good text, the best scholars will openly admit that it's incomplete. And now that we're fleshing out those incomplete pieces, what we're finding is that we once had as part of our history and our understanding the same thing that we find in these ancient and indigenous cultures. When we lost those understandings, their practices began to seem very strange to us, and we don't understand them. We call them primitive practices.
Do we think the Matrix occurred before this universe was formed, or did it come afterwards?
That's a good, very good question, George. And with the scientists I've spoken with, and in the research papers that we've had access to, the belief, no one knows for sure, so we'll just we'll preface it by saying that. But the belief is that it happened simultaneously with the birth of our universe, that there was a field of energy. There was a point in time when computer models and scientists believe our universe had just begun and it was expanding, but it had only expanded to about the size of a single green pea, if we can imagine that. So this is a fractions of a second after this primal moment that physicists call the Big Bang. And they say it was very compressed. If you took all the space out from between all the matter in the universe and compressed it into one place in time, it would be about the size of this green pea. And at that point...
Isn't that bizarre?
It is. You know, and I've got to tell you...
The
George,
brain can't
guys,
comprehend that. Great.
Well, they tell me that. And then they tell me it was about 18 million billion 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 degrees. And I said, come on, you guys, how do you know that? And they said, well, we don't know that, but we know it was hot. We know it was really small and really hot a long time ago. And as the universe began to expand very rapidly, as part of this expansion, this field is what was carried with the expansion. So into the void, the nothingness, or whatever it was that we believe was here before, this field began to expand and fill the universe as a substrate, if you will, or a framework, providing the container within which our universe exists. If we want to think about this field, it's the stuff that holds everything together. We know that, and that's what many people talk about. But it does more than that, George. It has also been found to be a bridge between our inner experiences of feeling and emotion and belief.
I think it's alive.
And our outer world. It is. It's a living essence. It's, number one, it's a container. Number two, it's the bridge between our inner and outer worlds. And number three, it appears to be, under laboratory conditions, and what the ancients said, also a mirror in the quantum essence of the stuff around us, of what it is that we claim to be real in our heart, coherent heart-based emotions. We'll talk about this tonight.
If it didn't exist, Greg, what would we have in this universe? Would we even have a physical realm?
Well, according to Max Planck, that's a great question, George. And according to Max Planck, the answer is no, we wouldn't, because Planck is saying that, and this is such a huge concept, he's saying that it's from this stuff, this non-conventional form of energy. It doesn't work the way we would expect energy normally to work. And that's why it's taken so long, scientists so long to validate it with our equipment.
Yeah.
But he said it's from this stuff that all physical matter originates. He says all matter originates and exists only by virtue of this force. So from his quantum perspective, 1944, what he's suggesting is if the field weren't there, that we couldn't have physical matter. It's the framework upon which the physical matter is actually hung, if we want to think of that in a visual sense.
That's incredible. But how do we know it exists?
Well,
we can't see it.
Precisely. We can't see it, and we've been hard-pressed to measure it because it is what's called a non-conventional field of energy. It doesn't respond to conventional methods of testing, to conventional electronic equipment. And there was a tremendous controversy back in the late 1800s, George, among scientists and philosophers and engineers as to whether or not this field actually existed, and a lot of heated debate. And there was a very famous experiment. It was first conducted in 1881 behind closed doors by a team, Michelson and Morley, and it was reproduced at Case Western University in 1887.
Well, they surely didn't have any technology, really, did they?
Well, you know, if you've got the concept right, George, you don't have to have some real advanced technology. If the concept is correct, there are ways to detect the field. But in my estimation, this was a good experiment. I think it was poorly interpreted, and what it's now called is history's greatest failed experiment.
All right, tell us what they were doing.
Well, let me just give an analogy. If our listeners right now were to walk out of their homes or offices or cars, wherever they're listening to this broadcast, if they moistened their index finger and held it above their head, and in the moment that they were holding their moistened finger above their head, they felt no wind against their finger. And from not feeling any wind against their finger, if they concluded that no air exists, that is the equivalent of the Michelson-Morley experiment. And we know that just because you don't feel wind in that moment doesn't mean the air isn't there. It's just not moving.
Exactly.
Well, the belief was that this field, if it in fact existed, there would be a motion. It was called the ether wind, and the field was called the ether at that time.
All right.
And because their equipment detected no motion in 1881 and then again in 1887, and these experiments, by the way, were published in the open literature, and I've put the references up on the website, and as we go through the evening, I can give the number of the references if people want to look these up on their own. But they were published in the American Journal of Science, 1887, volume 34. And what they said, they concluded in 1887, they said this field doesn't exist, George. And from that moment until the late 20th century, as good as our science and our physics have been and as well they've served us, we have been operating on the belief that everything is separate from everything else, that this stuff doesn't connect everything in the universe, and what happens in point A has no effect on what happens in point B. And if it looks like it does, it was just a coincidence. And now we have found ourselves in a place in the quantum world where the mysteries of quantum material have pushed scientists to do the experiments and to find the field exists. Now, this what's really interesting is that this same experiment was repeated again almost 100 years later, and it was in 1986. And this is the one reference I don't have up on the website, so I'm going to give it to our listeners. So
sure,
they can
and then tell us what happened, too.
Sure. It was conducted by a gentleman named E.W. Silvertooth. He was working on behalf of the United States Air Force.
E.W. Silvertooth?
Silvertooth.
All right.
He was working on behalf of the Air Force at the time. He repeated the experiment. He had better equipment, and lo and behold, George, he found not only did this field exist, but it existed within the parameters that were predicted 100 years earlier. It acted just the way Michelson and Morley believes that it would have with their equipment. He published this study in a very prestigious journal, Nature, volume 322, August 14th, 1986, page 590, and it messes everything up. And people, a lot of scientists just don't like to talk about it. The fact is, the experiment was repeated. It showed that this field is there, and it's led to a number of other experiments. And we can talk about those tonight.
Does this matrix allow us to have intuition, to be able to tap into the psychic realm, to be able to have telepathy between people we really connect with?
George, this is where it gets really relevant in our lives. Not only does it allow for these things, the belief now it is because this field is there that these things work the way they work. And beyond, remote viewing. When we're seeing halfway around the world or in another world from our living room, what is the conduit? We've got to ask ourselves, what is the conduit that is carrying our conscious awareness from point A to point B?
And what takes it there?
Yeah, we'll talk about some miraculous healings tonight. What we found is that there's a quality of human emotion that every human on the face of the earth is capable of. It's just a little shift in perception, and this quality of emotion literally will allow the stuff in this field to conform to what we feel in our hearts. So when we feel the feeling of the healing of a cancerous tumor, in the example I'm going to give later tonight, we can actually see inside the body of a living woman through an ultrasound, we can see her cancerous tumor disappear in the presence of three practitioners trained to hone this language of feeling in their bodies, and the field is the conduit that is carrying what they feel inside their bodies into the world around them. It's documented in Eastern traditions, and when I show this to medical people here in the West, George, they chalk it up to an anomaly and a miracle.
Do you think if you concentrate on this matrix, if you truly meditate about it, it puts you into it? You can go into it?
You're already in it, George. What we know is that it's not that it's out there somewhere. It's the stuff that holds everything together. Every cell in your body and my body and all of our listeners has emerged from the substrate of this matrix. It's what's holding us together right now. It's impossible not to be in this divine matrix. And what the scientists found in 1909, in their time, and what physicists like Dr. John Wheeler are saying today, not only are we part of it, it's impossible for us to be passive observers within this field. If we're conscious, if we are awake, we are always interacting and creating within this field, although we may not be conscious of what it is that we're creating. And that's part of our mastery that was described in 5,000-year-old texts. How we create, it's not a verbal language. It's the power of human emotion, George, and it's the very power that has been discouraged by males in the West for the last 400 years, well, 1,700 years.
Well, I was going to say, if people don't believe it, are they going to be able to get in it and use it?
They're already in it. And,
right.
and it's not, the beauty is
that
it's not something that we even have to believe. The studies, the experiments are solid. They're showing that this is there. They're showing that we affect this field through. Let me just back up a little bit.
Tell you what, why don't you hold that thought?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to take this break. Greg Braden's website, Greg Braden, BRADEN.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking about his work, The Divine Matrix. We'll be back. Okay, just mark your calendar, those of you who live around the Austin, Texas area, because on the 27th, I'll be at KLBJ's Talk Fest in Austin of this month. We'll do a little book signing right after that before I got to pop on a plane, but should be a fun event. And I think Friday night, they've got a contest going on with a dinner with me. So far, no one has entered the contest. No, I'm kidding. But you just call the station, KLBJ. Listen to them. They're talking about it every day. But I'll be out there next week, and we'll do a program out of there on Friday night with Linda Moulton Howe and Alex Jones. So that'll be a fun Coast to Coast show. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Greg Braden, our very special guest tonight. Greg, let's pick up where we left off, if you want.
Sure. George, just before the break, we were just talking about the the role that this field plays in the universe and the role we play within the field. And one of the things that's fascinating to me is, and especially as a former senior computer systems designer, is that a growing number of mainstream scientists are beginning to suspect that our universe works like a massive consciousness computer. And this is actually the terminology they're using.
I like that analogy, too.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. And if we think of the way computers work, just as every computer has a language that it uses to get things done, it appears that our consciousness computer of the universe has a language as well, and it's a language that we call human emotion and the power of feeling and what we believe to be true in our lives. Now, when I talk about that in front of live audiences, people tell me, Greg, it can't be that simple, because in our culture, we've been conditioned to, as we mentioned earlier, to discount the power of emotion and belief. But what the laboratory experiments are showing, George, is just the opposite, that it is the power of our awareness, of our expectation. When we're looking at the world around us, we expect to see something to happen. That expectation is an emotion in our bodies, and it is that emotion that sets into play a series of events that extend beyond our body into the world around us through this field, the divine matrix. And we're actually affecting and having a direct effect on the stuff our world is made of in ways that we're only beginning to understand.
Okay, well, with a computer, you program it. You put in the software, and it does all kinds of wonderful things. What is the software for the matrix?
The software is the power of human emotion. It is the belief. If we make this analogy, when we think about a computer, computers have operating systems, XP or Windows 98 or Mac or whatever it is. For all intents and purposes, those operating systems are fixed. If you want your computer to do something different, you usually don't change the operating system. What you do is you change the program or the way the program is working.
That's right.
And that's what I love about this analogy, George, is because we hear so many people saying that we need to change consciousness. But in this analogy, consciousness is the operating system. And that's happening within this divine matrix. We don't change consciousness. We change what we put into the consciousness, and that is our feelings and our beliefs. What the experiments have actually shown is that human emotion has a direct effect on the DNA inside of our bodies, literally changing the shape and the chemistry of the DNA in our bodies, that those effects extend beyond our bodies on the quantum level into the world around us. And this is the disconnect between us and when we look at 5,000-year-old traditions and we say, well, those are primitive traditions, or we see indigenous people in my part, we know part of the world, we live in northern New Mexico, we're surrounded by indigenous traditions.
Is that like saying stress kills, Greg?
Well, it can. It actually can. We actually talk about that in the book. So, in the book, what I've done is I've chosen three representative experiments. George, there are many out there, but I chose three that I thought were really powerful. And anybody that goes to the website under references, they'll see everything we're talking about tonight, so they don't have to take these notes. But the first one, it was actually performed by a Russian laser physicist, Vladimir Poponin, back in the early 90s. And for the first time under laboratory conditions that I'm aware of in the open literature, he took the stuff our world is made of, tiny particles of light called photons.
Mm-hmm.
And he did something that intuitively, it tells me that we're on the verge of a big shift in the way we think of our world because of the thinking underlying this experiment. Because what he did, George, was he took some human DNA and he put this DNA into a closed vacuum vessel with the stuff our world is made of, these little photons. And he asked the question. He said, what effect does human DNA have on the photons? He's saying, what effect does the stuff we're made of have on the stuff our world is made of?
Well, how do we know the opposite didn't occur?
Well, in conventional Western physics, there's nothing, there's absolutely nothing in conventional physics that suggests there would be any connection. And that's why it's so very cool when physicists ask these kinds of questions. And what he found and what was documented in a very famous experiment that is called the Phantom DNA experiment. People can Google that on the computer while we're talking. What he found was that in the presence of human DNA, the photons actually aligned themselves and were changed in the presence of the DNA. And when he took the DNA out of the tube, the photons acted like the DNA was still there. So to the best of my knowledge, under laboratory conditions, this is the first time we have seen documentation where the stuff we're made of is affecting our world. That's the first experiment. The second one was done by the folks at the Institute of Heart Math in Boulder Creek, California, where they isolated human DNA. It was placental DNA, so it wasn't in the body. It was in a vessel that was still kept alive. And they asked the question, they said, what effect does human emotion have on this DNA that's in this vase? And there's absolutely nothing in conventional Western physics that suggests that an emotion inside the body of an individual would have any effect on DNA several feet away. And what they found, they were able to measure both what they call the conformation or the shape, as well as the light properties of the DNA. And the bottom line was, as the emotions changed, the DNA changed in the presence of anger, hate, jealousy, rage, what we call negative emotions.
Okay, this is very similar to what Dr. Emoto has done with his water crystal pictures.
It's similar. It's
right?
Similar. It's similar, George, but here's the connection. What they found was this. Those are independent experiments. They may not even be aware of one another, and they're interesting. But when you put them together, along with other supporting experiments, they begin to tell a story. Because what the second experiment showed was that emotion is changing the DNA, and the first experiment showed that the DNA is changing the stuff our world is made of. So you take out that middle link, and what these experiments are showing is that when we can create certain qualities of feeling and emotion, these aren't thoughts, George, and this is the disconnect in the West. These are what are called coherent, heart-based human emotions, genuine emotions of love, compassion, forgiveness, hate, anger, jealousy, rage. We can create those kinds of feelings in our heart. They are changing the stuff we're made out of, and the stuff we're made out of is having a direct effect beyond our bodies on the stuff our world is made of, which is just what the ancient traditions are saying. And now modern scientists are beginning to understand this because they now have documented the existence of the field as the conduit that allows these kinds of things to happen. So this is the technical side that we're talking about. This is how feeling is the language that programs the consciousness computer of the universe. Now, we're talking in abstract terms, but all of a sudden this becomes very relevant in our lives because further experiments and the documents have shown in the open literature, as we mentioned earlier, spontaneous healings in the bodies of individuals and people around
them.
That's for one individual. I worked with a number of other authors in Princeton University on global experiments where Princeton University used their equipment that can measure shifts in human consciousness on a global level.
This is the egg testing?
It was GCP, Global Consciousness Project,
right.
When Dean Radin was with
exactly
with Princeton. And what we did was we organized hundreds of thousands of people to feel the feeling of peace in a window of time. And Dean called the people we were working with. He said, hey, what are you guys doing? You know, there's a blip on the screen.
With his random generators.
Yes,
right?
All we had done through the World Wide Web was we had taught people to feel these feelings of coherent emotions of peace. They weren't asking for peace or hoping that peace occurs or saying, dear God, please let there be peace. They were feeling the feelings as if the peace were already there. And this is what was showing up on the graphs at Princeton. And in major population centers around the world, statistically, what happened was that crimes against people declined during the time hundreds of thousands of people were doing this. Emergency hospital room visits declined, and it happened on this day in the cities where the stock market was, like in Chicago. The market actually soared during the window of time that this happened, and then all those statistics reversed.
That's amazing.
When people stopped. Well, this... George, this was all based on experiments that were done back in the early 1980s during the Israeli-Lebanese War when practitioners were trained in techniques of TM during that time, Transcendental Meditation. And they were to feel peace, not to ask that peace come to pass.
Not a prayer session.
And it wasn't. It was a very empowering place of simply feeling as if the peace were already there. And when they were placed in the war-torn areas in the early 1980s, the first Lebanese-Israeli war, during the window of time that the experiments were conducted, the terrorist activity stopped completely. Crimes against people declined. Emergency hospital room visits declined. And the scientists did it again and again just to make sure it wasn't a fluke. You know, it wasn't a certain holiday or a certain time of day or a lunar cycle or anything like that. And they published the results in a magazine. It was called the Journal of Conflict Resolution, December of 1988. And it was from these kinds of results that the other studies began. The bottom line to all of this, we could talk about any of these individually, make a whole program of it, but the key is, and what's being shown, is that something we do by choice inside of our bodies is having a direct effect on the world beyond our bodies, whether it's the healing of a cancerous tumor that we spoke about in the first segment, or whether it's peace between nations that we're talking about now.
Is it because it's affecting other people, or does it truly have some kind of an effect on an event?
Well, probably both are happening. And the Princeton studies, great scientists, wonderful people to work with, and I have tremendous respect for them, and I want to honor their work. They were the first to say, we don't know exactly why this works the way it works. The sense is, the suspicion is, that a few people focused who have learned to hone this language, they will transcend many people who are chaotically having this experience but don't know that they're doing it. In other words, people just going about their lives and don't really know what it is that's happening in the Middle East, for example, and a relatively few number of people who have honed their heart-based emotion of peace. And peace is what was experienced while they were doing that. And what it tells us statistically, George, the formula that was put together based on these studies tells us that relatively few people can have a profound effect on the world around them, on their communities, and even between nations. When we have learned to feel these feelings, not think them in our minds, and not ask that they be granted to us. We all do that from time to time, and that's a form of prayer, and it's good. It works. And this is a different way of looking at the world, suggesting that we're part of everything we see rather than separate from. And because we're part of all that we see, we're part of the solution as if we choose.
So is it safe to say we know it works, we just don't know how it works?
I think that's a good thing to say now. We could study it for another 100 years, George, and we may not understand it fully, but I believe we do understand it well enough that we can apply what we do know to help us become better people and create a better world in a world where we're facing unprecedented challenges in recorded human history, and where many people feel that if we're not at the brink, we're close to a brink of making choices that cannot be reversed and will forever change life as we know it in a way that we don't want to make those changes. Whether we're talking about a third global war, we're talking about nuclear proliferation, we're talking about powerful viruses on the planet that medicine doesn't know what to do with, as different as those things all seem, all of them are linked through this field, this divine matrix, and we now know that we are empowered as individuals and collectively. When we learn the language, first it's just becoming aware of how this field works. Secondly, it's learning to speak to this field in a way that is meaningful and responsible in our lives. So the fact that everything's connected, George, I know it's nothing new. We've heard it so long for many people, it almost doesn't mean anything because they haven't been able to use this connection in their lives. This work now is showing us not only are we connected, but this field provides the container and the bridge between our inner and outer worlds, and the mirror in the world around us for what it is that we choose to create in our hearts. And the irony is that to have collective results, we've got to learn to work together.
How does evil fit into this, Greg?
Well, that's a really good question. It might be too big to address before we go to the top of the hour, but what scientists now believe, what the evidence shows, and what 5,000-year-old texts tell us, is that this field appears to be neutral, an unbiased field. In other words, it doesn't know about our judgments of right and wrong and good and evil. It simply reflects what it is that we give it to work with, on the one hand. On the other hand, and this is, I think, the answer to the question you're asking, George, what the studies have shown, what scientists found, is that whatever someone wants to place into that field, they will experience in their bodies first before it ever goes anywhere in that field. So for those who are choosing to use this field for peace, love, compassion, understanding, their bodies, those are life-affirming emotions, and their bodies, that's the signal that sends the information to their brain that floods their bodies with life-affirming chemistry, and that life is what's perpetuated through the field. Anger, hate, jealousy, rage, those are life-denying emotions. And whoever it is that is attempting to send those kinds of energies in this field, they'll experience them in their bodies. Their heart will send that anger, hate, or rage to their brain, and their brain sends life-denying chemicals, increased stress hormones, lower immune response, decreased DHEA levels. And this is what the laboratory experiments are showing. So it's almost like a fail-safe. It's the field. I don't want to say the field doesn't care, but it's really a neutral field. And because of the way our universe, this corner of our universe, appears to work, we experience first whatever it is that we choose to put into that field before it ever goes anywhere else.
But but are you saying it does not distinguish the difference between good and bad?
The way the field, the quantum essence, the stuff itself appears to be neutral and unbiased, is the word that the scientists, the experimenters are using. The consciousness within that, and this is probably what we're going to get into in the next hour, what does this field mean in terms of consciousness? What does it mean in terms of heaven? What does it mean in terms of multiple dimensions? You were talking about these in your first hour of your program tonight. Telepathic experiences, out-of-body experiences, all of these things come into play when we're talking about the divine matrix. So it's not that the field itself appears to be a neutral field, but the consciousness within that field does know about right, wrong, good, and bad.
See, I think if someone, and just hear me out for a second here, Greg. Actually, a second is all you're going to hear me out for because we're at the top. So right. We'll come back and talk about this when we come back, Greg.
Great.
But basically, I want to talk with you about how an individual uses this divine matrix.
Sure.
And how it can backfire on him if he doesn't use it the right way.
Sure, I'll meet you here at the next hour.
You got it. I'll be back in a moment. Greg Braden, our special guest tonight, last hour, we'll open up the phone lines on Coast to Coast AM.